Welcome to today's Kluwen Internet Seminar. Today we'll be looking at CAPT Superfund site reuse through a series of in-depth case studies. Our session today has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response in their Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation Office. Our live broadcast is scheduled to run from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern. In just a moment, I'll turn things over to my co-moderator, Michelle Mahoney, as well as one of our first speakers, Melissa Friedland. But before we do that, we'd like to walk through a few pre-event instruction items for our participants. For those of you that might be new to the Kluwen webinar, I just want to refer you back to a reminder and registration email that you should have received with a complete set of instructions to join today's live broadcast. That email will tell you everything you need to do, including providing a link to something known as the seminar homepage. On that seminar homepage, you can read more about today's broadcast, find contact information for our presenters. There are links to download the presentations and take a look at other resources. We even have a short feedback form you can use after today's live broadcast. For now, though, you want to click a button that appears in the upper left corner of that page labeled Go to Seminar. Once you click that button, you'll be asked to identify yourself by name, as well as the number of people at your location, and then you'll be brought on board to our fully interactive Adobe Connect environment that we'll be using for the live broadcast. With this tool, you'll be able to watch in real time as our presenters deliver their talks from various locations across the country. If you have any problems joining us online, again, if you're having some issue with the check-in process, try closing or reloading or refreshing your browser window. We did have a momentary glitch there, but that is back up and fully functional. So if you had any problems joining us online, just refresh the browser and you should be able to pop right in. Again, if that still doesn't work, we do have copies of the presentation materials you can download from the resources or links page. Audio is available online by default. That means everyone can listen to this entire presentation online using their computer speakers or a pair of headphones. If you have problems with the online audio, please check your local volume settings first. You might need to adjust your speaker audio or your sound output to get it loud enough. If that doesn't work for you, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Please feel free to use the question box in the lower right corner of your screen to request the call-in number. I'll be more than happy to share it with those who need it. Just know if you join us on the phone lines, we will place all callers on the global mute, and we ask that you remain on that global mute to control background noises and other audio disruptions. As mentioned, we do have a Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. You should see a welcome message from me, Jean Ballant, in that window. And you can use that window to privately submit your comments, questions, as well as to report technical problems at any time. In fact, for those participants who are joining us right now, please take a moment and send in a quick test message into the Q&A window in the lower right corner. Feel free to test, say hello, send in a test, or just let me know how the audio and visuals are working for you at your particular location. Again, you can submit comments and questions at any time. We encourage you to submit those comments and questions early. We will take designated breaks, and at that time, our moderators will read questions out loud so the speakers can answer them. But there's no need to wait. You can submit those questions and comments as soon as they occur to you. Today's session is being recorded, and if you would like, we will send a free copy of the recording to you via email, where you can either replay it online or download locally and play it back as needed. Welcome as well to share that email with the recording information to anyone else that you think will find this to be a valuable expenditure of their time. And of course, you can browse the other SRI webinars that we currently have hosted, along with nearly 600 other internet seminars online at our Kluwen archive page. All right, so just a reminder, you should see a copy of the presentation materials will appear here on the left side of your screen. If you have any problems viewing this content, there is a button in the upper right corner that looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. If you click that once, it'll make the slides bigger. If you click that a second time, it'll shrink the slides back down. You can submit your comments and questions here in the box in the lower right corner by typing them in here and either pressing enter or hitting the cartoon bubble button to the right here, and that'll privately submit your comments and questions in. So I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today. So I'm going to turn things over to Melissa Friedland and Michelle Mahoney to kick things off today.
Thank you, Jean. Good afternoon, everybody. I hope whatever residual technical issues we have are getting resolved as we speak, but let me introduce myself. My name is Melissa Friedland, and I'm the National Program Manager for Redevelopment here at EPA. I want to thank you for joining us today as we continue to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative with our fourth and final quarterly webinar of fiscal year 2014. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI as we like to call it, hosts these webinars as part of a quarterly webinar series about the reuse of Superfund sites. Our webinars share the stories of sites and projects that are part of SRI, and they provide guidance and tools to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. Today's topic is a continuation of a webinar we did in July about opportunities for reuse on capped Superfund sites. We had record-breaking attendance and numerous requests for in-depth information afterwards, so we couldn't think of a more appropriate way to wrap up our 15th anniversary year than by developing a webinar that specifically catered to those requests. So for today's presentation, I'll start with a very brief introduction to EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, which plays a key role in supporting reuse as a priority at EPA. We'll then hear from Don McElroy in EPA's Region 1, who has a host of presenters to discuss the Iron Horse Park Shacker Landfill site. Don is going to be joined by Nicola Cornetta and Sandy Cameron of Urban Green Technologies, by Rob Kirsch of WilmerHale, by David Bonnet, GeoSyntech, and I believe Allison Linus is in the audience and will be able to answer any finance questions. And after Don's presentation, we're going to hear from Bill Denman in EPA's Region 4, and he will be joined by Richard Myers from the Broward County Solid Waste and Recycling Services, and they're going to discuss Davie Landfill. So these case studies will each feature a unique story of how reuse can be implemented at a capped site. And although a wide range of reuse types may be appropriate for capped sites, this webinar is going to focus specifically on alternative energy generation and recreational reuse activities at these two sites. So I'd like to just very quickly take a few moments to share the way that SRI can support site reuse before I hand things over to our case study presenters. And while EPA's primary mission is to protect human health and the environment, Superfund cleanups have also played an instrumental role in returning contaminated sites to productive use. SRI works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. We work at a national level, working to develop policies, tools, and performance measures that help support reuse activities, and also at a regional level, supporting site-specific projects and sharing lessons learned. And right before I go on to my next slide, I just want to say on the left side is the playground at the HOD Landfill Superfund site in Antioch, Illinois. This capped site hosts playground equipment, sports fields, and a wetlands environmental education area. Methane gas was extracted from the landfill that's been converted to energy and helps offset heating expenses for area schools. And on the right, you'll see a photograph from the Martin Marietta Sodico site in Charlotte, North Carolina. And this site now has an eco-industrial energy park, home to several large-scale renewable energy and alternative fuel projects. And both of these sites required caps as part of the remedy. So I want to be clear that EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, but in recent years, reuse has become an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals, and we see several benefits to this. By integrating reuse into the cleanup process, we can ensure a remedy matches the intended use of the property. We can protect remedies in the long term through property maintenance and institutional controls. We can open the door for local economic revitalization by attracting businesses to the area, and we can provide important social benefits such as ecological and recreational resources. And I think sometimes there's a misconception that redevelopment and reuse cannot happen at a site until the remedial action is completed. But I want to be clear that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. So whether you're looking at reuse while developing remedial action objectives for the site, when selecting a remedy, or even during long-term operation and maintenance of the remedy, reuse can inform the cleanup process in a way that helps ensure the long-term protectiveness of the site. And just very quickly, we've got, in our pictures, we've got a gas-to-energy conversion plant at the Pine Bend Sanitary Landfill in Inver Grove Heights, Minnesota. We've got a recycling facility at the Vertec site in Jacksonville, Arkansas. And we've got the DuPage County Landfill Blackwell Forest Preserve in Warrenville, Illinois, where capped waste was made into a hill known as Mount Hoy. It's now used for recreational purposes, including snow tubing. And we've got solar photovoltaics at the Apache Powder Site in Arizona to enhance the groundwater cleanup. So SRI has found that site reuse provides a variety of economic, environmental, and social benefits. We've seen that commercial reuse of sites can support new jobs and tax revenues to a community, and reuse can also lead to better protection of human health and make a site less likely to be a target for vandalism or illegal dumping. As I mentioned earlier, we selected today's topic because our audience specifically requested site-specific reuse information. So let's not wait any longer to dive into our case studies. Feel free to ask questions of our speakers. We'll try and answer questions after each section, but we may hold some questions if we think future presenters will address them. There will also have time at the end of the presentation for remaining questions. So just right before we move on, these are before and after photos of the Solatron microwave site in Port Salerno, Florida, and they illustrate how reuse benefits the site and the surrounding community. Prior to reuse, the site was abandoned and an eyesore to the local community. Today, it's home to the Port Salerno Industrial Park. The industrial park provides much-needed space for industrial facilities, and the businesses operating there provide jobs to the local communities. So I think at this point, I am ready to hand it over to Don McElroy, who is our Region 1 Remedial Project Manager, and who's going to start off by introducing his group and talking about the Iron Horse Park Superfund site, and specifically the Schaffer Landfill portion of the site. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Melissa. Again, this is Don McElroy, and I'm Project Manager for EPA up in Region 1. And as Melissa said, I'm going to give a brief introduction to the Iron Horse Park site and specifically the Schaffer Landfill, which is a portion of that, and then I'll hand things over to a host of people to go through the reuse efforts that took place at Schaffer to accomplish the solar facility that's there now. Let's see if give me one second. I have one little technical difficulty to get started. There's just an overview of Iron Horse Park. It's a 533-acre industrial complex that's north of Boston in Billerica, Massachusetts, kind of near the New Hampshire border. It includes manufacturing and commercial facilities, rail-related facilities, a number of landfills, former wastewater lagoons. And there are currently still numerous operating businesses there. Historically, it had pretty much the same commercial and industrial uses with a significant rail presence throughout its roughly 100-year history. Iron Horse Park became a Superfund site in 1984 when EPA put it on the National Priorities List. And the site has been split up into four operable units for purposes of remediation, and I assume there may be some non-EPA people here. Operable units can be thought of as phases or separate areas or sites. In Iron Horse Park, the different operable units are essentially different sites. I don't have pointability here, but in this plan view, the Schaffer Landfill is the sort of eyeglasses feature that's over to the right. And then the rest of the industrial complex is kind of to the left or to the west, taking up most of the area. So let me go briefly through the operable units and what's gone on there in the past. Operable Unit 1, which is kind of central to the site, is a former wastewater lagoons area, about 15 acres, had a record of decision picking a remedy in 1988 to address contaminated sediment and soil. Initially, it was bioremediation. We didn't get all the way there with that, and ultimately, there was a modification to use off-site asphalt batching, and that remedy, that cleanup has been completed. Operable Unit 2 is the Schaffer Landfill, which is the focus of the presentations today, 60-acre landfill. That's got those two lobes, makes the sort of eyeglass shape, and it accepted commercial and residential waste for 30-plus years. Last waste went in there in 1986, roughly. There was a record of decision selecting capping for the remedy there in 1991, and the construction started in 2001 and was completed in 2003, and O&M operation maintenance has been ongoing since then. The third operable unit consists of the remainder of the source areas of the, at the site, of which there are seven, and the source control rod was issued in 2004 that chose capping remedies for various landfills and contaminated soil areas at six different areas, and then maintenance of an existing cap at the seventh area. And they're kind of spread out in small bubbles throughout the balance of the industrial park. So there's a bunch of areas within that industrial park for which there's no remedial actions that that have taken place or will take place. And of those seven areas, three of them have been completed, and the other four of the designs have been completed. So they're online to go forward with the cleanups. The fourth operable unit consists of site-wide surface water, groundwater, and sediment. And there was a 2011 rod, which primarily includes targeted sediment removal and then groundwater monitoring site-wide. Let's see if my technology works now. Yes. So since the reuse of Schaefer is the focus here, I want to just give a little detail about the remedy there. And again, I mentioned earlier the remedy was capping, again, 60-acre landfill. And the cap, comparatively simple, consists of subgrade soils over the waste, over the regraded waste, providing sloping at the top of the landfill and a smooth subgrade along over the entire landfill for the liner. Subgrade generally a foot or more thick throughout. Then installing a textured membrane liner, 60 mil liner over the landfill, drain layer, drainage layer, synthetic drainage layer, and fabric over the drainage layer on top of the liner, and then 18 inches of soil, the top six of which was loam to be seeded, which overlay the drain net and filter fabric. And the construction included, in addition, stormwater conveyance and detention basins, combined landfill gas and leachate collection wells, which were spread throughout the two lobes, an enclosed flare, which in this photo would be near the road to the far left, so to the far west of the landfill area, and then perimeter fence and monitoring and maintenance. And this photo shows the lobe to the right has been completed and vegetation is starting to grow, and then the second lobe on the left is in the midst of construction, so there's a combination of subgrade is the sort of light gray stuff, and if you look really closely, you can see a little bit difference of liner and drainage net and filter fabric in the darker areas. Now, I think I mentioned before, construction began in 2001, spring of 2001, and ultimately was completed in the summer of 2003 with O&M activities beginning in the fall of 2003. And again, O&M has continued in a pretty unremarkable sense since then, meaning that there's been just normal landfill issues, mowing the grass, minor burrowing, tree might fall on the fence, need to be repaired, but pretty low-key kinds of things. And that's pretty much what I wanted to go through. I guess I'd like to turn things over to the, I think, Sandy, Nicola, and others who will talk about the transition from this cap landfill to the solar farm. Thanks.
Yeah, hi. John, it's Sandy, Cameron, and Nicola. We'd like to thank you for turning the presentation over to us, and we want to welcome everybody to the webinar from Urban Green Technologies. I want to thank you, Don, for working with us on this project and being so helpful from the EPA, and Janet Waldron for being very helpful from the Mass DEP. The two of you were very instrumental in working with us and allowing this job to go to completion. Urban Green Technologies started back in 2010, and the initial idea for Urban Green Technologies, now known as UGT, was to put solar on landfills. So we actually looked in Illinois and Wisconsin initially back in 2010, and then we started to look nationally at opportunities, and we looked in Hawaii, we looked at other states, and we found very comfortable then in looking in Massachusetts. As we dug into it further, we were able to look at some of the landfills in Massachusetts, and we came upon Schaefer Landfill, and we started to do some additional research on it. And we met a gentleman who's going to speak next, Rob Kirsch, who was very instrumental in this whole process coming together because of his knowledge of the project, the PRPs, the town of Billerica, as well as working closely with the EPA and MassDEP. So those are the initial parties that really allowed us to work closely and pull this together, along with a number of consultants, electrical consultants, EPCs, and others in the Massachusetts area. We were fortunate enough with this particular landfill to find 40 acres that were relatively flat. There were some sloped areas, and perpetual power came along with an adjustable racking system that we were able to use successfully in making this process work, because we had an 18-inch cap down to the impermeable membrane that we could not broach. In fact, they didn't want us to go more than just a couple inches into the cap, and so we had to ballast everything on top. So there were a lot of interesting engineering situations that we had to deal with to make this happen in conjunction with the assistance of all of our consultants. Nicola, do you have anything you'd like to add?
No, we went over the main things. I just wanted to say that Schaefer Landfill is the largest solar development on a Superfund site. We had the strong support of property owners, the town of Billerica, the state of Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, US EPA, and National Grid, the utility that services the site. Prior to developing, we had to perform extensive analysis and vetting of this site. We worked very closely with our consultants on this. We worked hard to develop a site layout that will maximize the maximize the project size and output, taking into account steep slopes. The slopes were up to 20% on both sides. As well as uneven terrain that forced us to create sub-areas group, as well as to level our microgrid racking to level the sub-area structure. And, the main concern was that the solar project should not affect the cap remedy implemented for the landfill, so we used the ballasted racking approach, as Sandy mentioned. And that's pretty much it. We'll turn it over to Rob now.
Thank you very much, guys, and welcome, everyone. This is Rob Kirsch, and I'm a partner at WilmerHale. That's with my colleagues here. We've been representing the potentially responsible party group at the Schaefer Landfill for more than 20 years now. And what I would like to do in the next couple of minutes is just introduce you to the different players and the perspectives that they bring to this project, and I will start off by saying the reason that we as a PRP group, and I think our group had about 35 or 40 members to it, was as interested as it was in this development is because as part of the settlement with the former owners and operators of the landfill, back in the 1990s, we acquired the right to develop energy on the landfill. At the time that we did that, we anticipated that the development would involve energy produced by landfill gas, but in truth, the landfill, as Don pointed out, stopped accepting waste in the 1980s and was actually too far down on the gas curve to actually be adequate for investment. But it turned out to be a very good site with sufficient space and exposure for solar development. So we were very interested in bringing a new use to the property that could also result from the PRP's perspective in a recovery of some of the funds that were invested in closing the landfill. So just to run through the list of players that are now up on the screen, obviously EPA was a key one. This is a national priorities list site. The landfill is an operable unit of the overall Iron Horse Park site. We have ongoing responsibilities to maintain the cap remedy that's in place there for the next, still for another 30 plus or minus years. And we weren't going to be able to do anything on the landfill absent the acquiescence of EPA. And as I believe was pointed out already by Sandy and Nicola, EPA has been very supportive from the outset. And the second key government player was the Department of Environmental Protection, and that was from two perspectives. On the one hand, DEP was the other enforcement agency responsible for work at the landfill, and that was done under the guidance of Janet Waldron, who's also been on the site along with Don for many, many years. And in addition, because the site was going to be redeveloped, the Commonwealth determined that a reuse permit, which is typically something that is used in connection with a solid waste landfill, would be applicable here, even to the redevelopment of a Superfund site. That was an initial area of legal question, and frankly, everyone decided to just let it ride and seek the permit. But that meant that in addition to the Superfund, the state Superfund program with Janet, one of the parties that was very, very key to the redevelopment was the Solid Waste Office at the DEP, and that is the office that ultimately gave the reuse permit under which the solar facility was constructed and is now being operated. The town of Billerica was a key player and remains a key player for a number of reasons, and the first of which, from the perspective of the PRP group, which wanted this development to go, is that the town was a responsible party that had not settled its liability at the site. So just keep that in mind, and I will come back to it later. In addition, the town also had not received any tax revenue from the site since the mid-1980s. The property had essentially become part of the delinquent tax rolls in Billerica, and by the time this project was proposed, I think the unpaid back taxes, even for a Superfund site, totaled approximately $400,000, plus several hundred thousand dollars in interest, bringing the total at issue to about $1 million. In addition, various town boards had to be involved in approving this kind of a project. The planning board, because it was an energy development, there were wetlands implications because this site does border various wetlands. There were tax issues, which I've just mentioned, because nothing could go forward until there was an understanding of both what would happen with respect to the back taxes and also what the obligations of the facility were going to be going forward. And while I don't have the qualifications to go into it in detail, I think anyone who's interested in developing this kind of a project will realize that some ability to predict the cash burden on a project is going to be important to make it go forward in the long run. And then finally, two other offices that were critical at the town level, in addition to the various boards that had authority, were the executive of the town, the town manager, who really had oversight and was the quarterback to many of the things that were happening, and the town council, who was key to understanding both the internal politics and the mechanisms for resolving some of the particular procedural hurdles that were presented both by a municipality and by the fact that here in New England, we have a very ancient form of government at the local level called the town meeting, and some of the aspects of this project actually had to be approved by the meeting, which meant going to a meeting of hundreds of citizens and gaining approval for a fairly detailed project. Then the PRP group, obviously our interest was that we had the right to develop this project, and the group wanted to recover some of its investment. The remedy to actually construct the cap that Don described earlier cost about $12 million, give or take. But the operation of the landfill, the work that went into studying it and determining what remedy would be put in place, reimbursing EPA for some of its past costs and the ongoing costs of the state, had an overall budget of about $25 million from our perspective. So the ability to recover some of that was key to us. Our grid operator, National Grid, is the company that supplies the power to customers in the area. Like most businesses in that position, very conservative in how it approaches things, very tied to its own schedules. And since if you have a project like this, you will need to tie it in to your provider, and unless you can coordinate with the schedule of that provider, it can prove a terrific obstacle to getting to the point where the project will actually generate revenue and be marketable. And those are all critical factors with your with your investors. We had the legal team here was consisting of lawyers at EPA, lawyers working for the state and at the Department of Environmental Protection and the Attorney General's office. We had my role, counsel for the town, and at various times counsel for different entities that were involved either as consultants or in some instances as potential investors or purchasers of the facility. And in a critical place, someone like Dave Bonnet, who you will hear from in a few minutes, who both had a history at the site in closing the remedy historically and also more recently in understanding how the redevelopment project would work and being able to maintain the integrity of the landfill cap, which was of paramount interest to many of the local boards that oversaw the project and granted approvals, and in particular, to EPA and DEP, who wanted to make sure that all the work that had been done to secure the landfill was not put at risk. Finally, we had the site owner. In this instance, the surrogate for the site owner really was the potentially responsible party group because the site owner had transferred the right to develop here. We worked with them closely when we needed to obtain sign-offs and approvals, but by and large, we were able to avoid the pitfalls of even a further party because we already own those rights. And then finally, the investors who came into this project and made it possible to go, because obviously unless the other members of the project team are sitting on very significant resources, there won't be enough cash available to put this together. And the investor team and the willingness to have the ability to have a sophisticated investor team is especially important in this kind of a site, because we were, after all, talking about redeveloping not just a landfill where there's quite a bit of precedent for installing solar and other alternative energy projects, but a Superfund landfill where the fairly draconian liability scheme is always lurking in the background and making lawyers and accountants who support investors especially wary because of the number of pitfalls that were there. So without a very sophisticated investor team that really understands what risks are real and what risks are more illusory, you can't put a project like this together. But fortunately in this instance, the investor team that came forward with Capital Dynamics was very, very sophisticated and able to carry the project through. So I think those are the parties, and that's the position that they were in as we started into the project.
And I think with that, we'll turn to Dave Bonnet, who's going to discuss the project design.
Thanks, Sandy and Rob. My name, obviously, is Dave Bonnet. I've got 30 years of experience in construction, the majority of which is through waste containment facilities. One of the takeaways that I want to share with you, this was a wonderful project to be involved with. Geosyntec, we acted as the engineer record for the civil and landfill-related aspects of the project for the permitting and construction. And I'll just quickly touch on the permitting process itself so that people understand sort of the hierarchy that we went through to get the construction completed. As you saw from Rob's slide, there's several parties involved. The key ones regarding permitting, obviously US EPA, the Department of Environmental Protection, and the town of Billerica. And each one of them sort of came to the table with a particular focus that they wanted to see with regards to permitting. Obviously, US EPA, their focus, bottom line was, you know, no adverse impacts to the approved remedy could occur. You know, that was number one. Though they didn't have a permitting methodology in place to take the remedy from closure to a redevelopment for solar, so it was deferred to MassDEP. One of the important things through the process was the fact that since the site had been closed, there was design precedence that had been set. So we had material specifications. We had a health and safety plan, stormwater pollution prevention plan, and an O&M plan, and that was all from the remedy. So we had a basis from which to work from. And I should explain that Geosyntec, I was involved in the oversight of the remedy that occurred between 2001 and 2003. And so there was this 10-year post-closure care time frame that the site lay as a vegetated two landfills. The total cap is 63 acres, and again, as Don mentioned, the cap consists of 18 inches of vegetated protective soil, a geocomposite drainage layer, a 40 mil geomembrane cap, and 12 inches of subgrade. And with the MassDEP and their permitting process, they have a post-closure use permit that they require you address 19 issues. Those issues can really be boiled down for this particular site to slope stability, stormwater, and O&M. So looking into the permit, the key things that we looked at were obviously the various loading conditions, the PV panels and the racking system, the wind and the snow loads, and these panels act like mini sails, so wind is typically the critical piece to that. The other things that we had to look at was the electrical equipment, the inverters and transformers. They're fairly heavy. We needed to understand how they could be put into place and make sure that we evaluated it. And then the temporary construction traffic and the emergency vehicle access was important as well. We looked at settlement, as any landfill. You get breakdown of the organics and the waste will settle. Obviously, we wanted to make sure there was the minimal impact by the addition of the solar facility on the cap, that it was going to remain, the integrity was going to remain, as well as the stormwater was an important issue. And then the other thing we looked at was the stability. You heard that, you know, UGT wanted to push the envelope. We wanted to get the racking system on up to 20% slope, so we had to verify global and veneer stability with the concrete blocks, as you see in the photo. and we did that through a interface friction testing program. The other, turning to the town of Billerica, there was two entities that were involved in the permitting process. The planning board, through a special permit, their focus was mostly on politics and the economic benefits that UGT has talked about. They had hired a third-party engineer. They were focused a lot on stormwater. And, for instance, they requested that the impervious coverage in the stormwater calculations basically include the PV panels themselves. We developed best management practices in reaction to their concern. So we had a drip edge stabilization and a flow obstruction BMP, as well as the impact of shading by the panels on the vegetation. The other entity, the Board of Health, as you may know, in the state of Massachusetts, the Board of Health has local jurisdiction over landfills. Even though this was a Superfund site, they came to the table basically through the fire department, who wanted assurances with respect to access their emergency vehicles. And so this was more a post-closure, you know, after the solar panels were in place. So as you see in the photo, the PV system covers about 25%. So there are two landfills. The residential landfill, 25% of the closed area has these panels on it, and approximately 40% of the commercial landfill, which is the larger one. Altogether, there's about 20,000 panels. They're all mounted on what you see. Below them is the adjustable, we call the micro block racking system, and each of the micro blocks basically tie together anywhere from 20 to 30 panels and generally have a minimum of four of those concrete footings that you see in the foreground. Those footings weigh anywhere from 150 to about 600 pounds. In addition to the racking system, all the support structures, there's over 140 combiner boxes. There were 10 inverters, 6 transformers, and obviously we had to look at all those in terms of the permitting. And ultimately what was installed was just under 6 megawatts of direct current that was tied in to the national grid system. And once we got the permitting in place, and that was early 2013, we had all the permits in hand. And then by November, we were holding a pre-construction, and the majority of the construction happened between January through June of this year. And just last month, we had the opening ceremonies, so the official opening ceremonies. So we were successful in getting through the permitting and the construction piece to it. So with that, I'll turn it back to Sandy.
Yes, thank you, Dave. The next slide shows the important component, the electrical connection from the solar array out into the national grid system. National grid came on early in the game with us to work closely in helping us and directing us in how to what we can connect to, what the costs were going to be to connect, and you know what the time process was, because connecting to a grid system can be expensive and it can take a lot of time. So that all has to be worked into your time and financial budget ahead of time, so that you know exactly you know what is going to be involved. We were very lucky. We got a good group of people from National Grid that we could work with. We've worked with other utilities, but they seem to be very special in communicating with us and trying to do what's right to help solar development. The power from this solar array, as Rob said earlier, the off-taker is the town of Bella Rica, and so they've benefited in a number of ways. They've been able to have green power. They've been able to get power at a good rate, and from the whole process, they've been able to generate tax revenue, which they weren't able to get before. So it was really a win-win situation for the town of Bella Rica, and that's been a real positive, and that's part of the reason why this whole process moved forward. Is the end result was going to be very beneficial to the community, and that's what we were all shooting for. Rob, you're next.
Thanks, Sandy. So we're jumping ahead. Before launching into the long-term maintenance, just sort of revisit some of the things that have been said by David and Sandy getting up to here, because it's a lot of it's gone unsaid. But there are a number of players, if you remember back to the slide we had up on the screen earlier, and particularly when you're talking about the various bodies and boards, both ranging from the Department of Environmental Protection, which had its issues, the various town boards, and in this instance, the simultaneous negotiation that had to go on between the potentially responsible party group and the town, both to settle the past claims that were separating us. It's important for any project like this that someone act in the role as a project quarterback and really understand where all the moving parts are. And how each of those parts and the resolution of the various issues that are outstanding can implicate either the ultimate success of the project or, equally as important, the timing of the project. There were many, many moving parts in this instance, often moving simultaneously and occasionally moving in conflicting directions that we had to coordinate. And a lot of that came down to the folks at UGT understanding what balls were in the air and how they were going to come together, and ultimately also the investor team that came in from Capital Dynamics and pulled things together. But in terms of the physical aspects now, getting back to the slide and the elements of the project that David and Sandy have just talked about, some of the key aspects ongoing are, as the PRP group, we had a 40-year obligation to maintain the integrity of the closed landfill, make sure that essentially that water continued to run off it and that no plant roots grew deeply enough to actually penetrate the impermeable synthetic cap liner. There's essentially a piece of rubber-like synthetic material buried 30 inches below the soil surface here. That's separating the cap from new liquid, hopefully, so that any of the trash down there, which was the reason for declaring the site a Superfund site, will not come into contact with water and will not contaminate the groundwater in the area. So we had to maintain our ability to continue to preserve the integrity of the cap. In addition to that, putting this kind of a facility on the surface of the cap adds to the complexity and the cost of those activities. While a lot of the engineering was done by Dave's team and others to make sure that we understood the implications for settlement, for drainage, for plant growth and maintenance, et cetera, all of which are important to making sure that the cap remains stable, that obligation was going to be, those factors were going to complicate the group's obligation, and under our agreement with UGT, we maintained the cap preservation obligation because, frankly, we thought it was simpler and more straightforward to keep it with us. We were experienced with it. We had a track record, and we felt that we could accomplish that. In addition, however, there is a whole raft of activities that have to be accomplished in order to maintain the integrity of the solar project and to make sure that it continues to produce power on a basis that's adequate to satisfy the project and the investors' needs. And for that, there are a range of activities that have to be done. Those are done separately. And we also wanted to make sure that the site remains secure. Now, from that perspective, we had the benefit of being at a Superfund site because one of the requirements that we already addressed in order to satisfy the regulations that that Don and Janet were overseeing was to make sure that the site was cut off from easy access to the public for environmental health and safety reasons. So we had a fence, and here the site was already fairly well isolated. In addition to that, we've added electronic access and the ability to monitor the site. We do have personnel out there on a fairly regular basis, slightly more frequently now as the plant gets organized and up and running than was the case previously, and eventually we'll go back to a more routinized level of actual human presence on the site. But things are set up now so that we can monitor and maintain electronically some security, understand what's happening on the site, and if necessary, call for people to come out and actually visit visit in person to look at the site. So I think that's what I have to say on the long-term maintenance side. So those are the pieces. The project and the Superfund obligations run for roughly the same amount of time here, you know, another 25 or 30 years. And having that kind of continuity is important. So I think we're ready to go to the next slide, which I've already started to touch on, and I'll start the discussion and then invite others, David and Sandy in particular, to come in. But I think that the thing that I want to speak to again is what I mentioned a minute or two ago, which is the most important thing, is the number of different interests that are implicated by the various bodies that have to approve the project, and that ranged here from three different town boards, Don McElroy and his team at EPA, both the solid waste and the Superfund side program at the Department of Environmental Protection, and people within National Grid who had to oversee the connection of the site to them, had to oversee any additional resources and line work that had to be done in order to make this connect. There are a number of different players, and then right down to the management of the responsible party group, which would also, in this instance, also happen to bring into play the ownership interests. You had UGT's own interest because it needed to get this project going, and this was UGT chose to bite off something big by having its first project also be a Superfund site. And then the investors and potential purchasers of the project who came in looking not only at the viability financially of the project, but of the liability issues that they would have to face and the potential implications for financing and for investor return. So having a quarterback to watch all that on a project is critical in maintaining constructive relationships among all the parties that are involved also becomes critical. I think you've already heard, and we couldn't reiterate enough, the fact that here, right from the start, there was real cooperation from EPA, that there were folks within DEP and within the town who had the long-term interest of the project at stake, and we were able to resolve a number of issues, which at times seemed unending both in their scope and in the and in their interrelatedness and complexity, and just being able to be constructive, keep the long-term interest of the project in mind, led us to be able to take what was by and large a tax delinquent project property that was going to be a burden to the town and just a maintenance obligation for the PRP group and for EPA and DEP, and turn it into a productive corporate citizen for this municipality, one that provided the municipality actually with significant savings over its normal electric bill, since the town is the customer that was taking off the power here. And then let me turn it over to David for his comments on the oversight and the permitting process.
Thanks, Rob. I think my takeaway, and it's no surprise based on who was invited to the party, there's so many individuals and companies involved, but the important piece is regarding the permitting and construction is trying and successfully, hopefully, managing the decision makers, in this case EPA, DEP, and the town, and to make sure that you were not getting conflicting requests or requirements imposed on the project that would conflict. So if one party said they were interested in this and the other one said something slightly different, there was obviously a need to hash that out. So the key throughout this project, through communications, is the management of the parties, and obviously the EPA, where they're, and that's why I went through sort of their key issues, was to always come back to those key issues and make sure that they were satisfied and that the other parties involved knew that they were being taken care of through either EPA, DEP, or the town. So that again, no surprise with the lessons learned, but it was certainly the takeaway that people should understand. Sandy, do you have anything else to add to that?
Well, the only thing I have to say is I wanted to thank all the participants and as well as everybody that was associated with this project because, we started working on it in January of 2011, and it took till August of 2014 for the ribbon cutting. That's quite a long period of time, and there was a lot of persistence and a lot of help provided by so many in making this happen. And I just wanted to thank everybody for the opportunity of working with everyone to make it happen. From my point of view, it was really a fascinating experience because you had so many different parties involved. I mean, just a project that is on level ground, shall we say, without the Superfund and the DEP involvement is pretty straightforward. You obviously have to get approvals through, the local town and planning boards, meeting the codes and things like that. But this one had a lot of extra involvement and complications in it, and we're just happy that it was able to come off for so many people, as well as the investor Capital Dynamics and the city or the town of Bella Rica. That's all I have.
That is great. I want to thank you all for doing such a good job. And we actually have some questions that have come in. I think, Dave, this question might be for you. Someone is saying, was the Sheffer landfill constructed with a bottom liner? And if not, what precautions are being taken to prevent leaching to groundwater? Dave, I think that's for you, but others feel
sure.
Free.
Yeah. As it was mentioned, the two landfills were active back in the mid-40s all the way through 1986. During that time, there was no requirement for the bottom liners as we know it today. So the other important issue is there was the groundwater was fairly high due to the wetlands that are around it. So there was the remedy calls for the cap to start to minimize the infiltration of precipitation in through the waste. So there was no bottom liner, but the cap was installed as the remedy to minimize the percolation of rainwater through the waste.
Okay, thanks. And I think this one might be for Rob. Can you call that one up? How did the PRP group recover money from the solar project?
In two different ways. One way was direct and one was indirect. Because the town was a potentially responsible party, and the town had a real interest here because of the tax revenue stream that was going to come from the project. And part of the deal that I didn't really go into in a lot of detail was that the town and the PRP group resolved their respective claims, and that resulted in some income stream coming into the group over the term of years. I should add that this was something that the town was easily able to do, because the revenue stream that it will pay to the group to settle its liability is derived entirely from the money that it will receive from the project over the next 25 years. So we were able to both fund the group and give the town the benefit of both a decreased power costs and pretty significant tax revenues. The second component is project rent. Because we owned the ability to develop the landfill from an energy perspective, we converted that right into an easement. We did that because we needed to have something that could be recordable and would be recognized as an element that could be financed and in the context of the deal. So we have an easement to develop an easement to build the energy on the site, and that's part of a lease. We've leased the rights under the easement to the project, so we also have a revenue stream that is essentially rent for the project for the life of the power plant.
Thanks. I think this question is for Dave. Is the foundation system and solar panels flexible to anticipated and unanticipated differential settlement, i.e. flexible overtime or high maintenance over the long haul?
So the racking system, as I call the microblock system, consists of concrete blocks that are tied into a racking system, a metal racking system that's bolted together like a big mechanical set. There is lots of flexibility in not only the installation, the adjustment, the height in the system, but as well as with the installation on up to 20% slopes. The landfill has undulations, and the system could be installed on these undulations. And looking into the future as best we can with settlement, the anticipated addition of the blocks, we found that the system could tolerate the predicted settlement, so the system was well adapted for landfills.
Thanks. Now, we have a property tax question now. I'm not quite sure who this is for. Rob, I don't know if that would be you or someone else, but someone's asking, you had mentioned that some of the property was tax delinquent, and who owned that property and who was not paying taxes on it, I guess, and could you stop paying your taxes if you owned a Superfund site? I think
Well, certainly someone who owns a Superfund site should consult their own lawyers if they want to view what their rights or obligations are in terms of tax issues. Here, the site, which is called, this operable unit is called the Schaefer Landfill, and was owned by business interests associated with the Schaefer family, and those interests did not have any revenue stream once the landfill stopped operating in the 1980s, so they stopped paying their taxes in the 1980s. That the taxes were not paid on the real estate, so on the landfill itself, the hills that you saw on the screen. It's not that uncommon, in my experience, for property owners to stop paying taxes on Superfund sites, in part because the owners don't feel that much of a risk anymore. If the property is taken, they lose ownership of a Superfund site, which is not necessarily considered a loss in many instances. That can be a real opportunity for someone who's saddled with something like this. But that's why the statutes, at least at the federal level and in Massachusetts and many other jurisdictions at the state level, protects a municipality in the event that it has to take a property because the owner is not paying taxes, the municipality can be protected from the kind of draconian liability that otherwise could flow with acquiring a property. But here it was the property taxes that hadn't been paid historically, and once the project was in place, the town received both its back taxes, not interest, but back taxes were paid, and on a going forward basis, taxes on the improvement, and that was all rolled into a single agreement. There was a contract that's called a payment in lieu of taxes, or PILOT is the acronym, agreement that was put in place here. And that was one of the things that I mentioned at the very outset. It provides some certainty and predictability for the project as to what its tax obligations are going to be for every year, so that can all be worked into the to the calculus of whether the deal works and how it stands.
Thanks. I think we need to move on. We can take more questions later at the end of the next presentation, but I want to make sure we give Bill and Richard a chance to tell us their story. So, Bill, I'm going to turn it over to you.
All right. Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate that. Hi, everyone. My name is Bill Denman. I'm a Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Coordinator in Region 4 and have been for 12 or 13 years. And I've had the opportunity to work on a lot of really interesting redevelopment projects, and the one we're going to talk about today is one of the ones that I found most interesting. I wish I could take more credit for it, but most of the credit belongs to Broward County and Richard Myers, who will be presenting in just a minute after I kind of tee up and introduce the site. Began working on the Davy landfill site back in the mid-90s. The site is in Davy, Florida, which is just west of Fort Lauderdale. It was a landfill that was an incinerator back before the 70s, and incinerator ash was put in the landfill, and then after the incinerator was closed down, the landfill started accepting municipal trash. And so, as the landfill was being closed, Broward County had some ideas about how the area was growing and what the need was. So, as I said, let's see, the site is located in Davy, which is in Broward County, just west of Fort Lauderdale. It's a 209-acre piece of property. In an area that really grew and developed, I guess, in the late 90s and early 2000s. In anticipation of that growth, population growth around the site, the county realized that they needed to have more recreational space and decided that the Davy landfill would be a good place to try to do some of that. So looking at the site history, again, Richard Myers, he's the program manager for Broward County Solid Waste and Recycling Services Program. He's going to provide you a much more detailed look at the history. But I wanted to point out a couple things in addition to what I've already said. The cleanup of the site was really performed under the oversight of two programs, both CERCLA and RCRA. I'm sure as most of you, if not all of you, know RCRA regulates landfills in most cases, and CERCLA regulates abandoned facilities. And so this was one of those sites that at the beginning of the Superfund program was put on the MPL, and Superfund or CERCLA, the CERCLA program dealt with two primary issues. One was a sludge lagoon where there had been the disposal of grease trap waste and other material that was excavated, and at the same time, the landfill was being closed under a RCRA landfill closure permit that was issued by FDEP, the state delegated authority for implementation of RCRA. And so we kind of had two things ongoing at once. So the remedy was to take the material from the grease trap, from the sludge lagoon, stabilize it, and put it in a cell of the landfill as it was being closed. And so the second issue that CERCLA dealt with was the groundwater issue. We had wells installed around the site. We connected some folks that lived nearby to municipal water and monitored the groundwater until it attained the cleanup standards. And so now the site's been deleted from the NPL in 2006, and so CERCLA's pretty much done with it. And so at one more thing before I turn it over to Richard is in Region 4, we developed a program to recognize people who had gone above and beyond in the redevelopment of a Superfund site. And in 2010, we presented Broward County with our Excellence in Site Reuse Award for their work on this site. I think you'll be as impressed as I was at all of the activities that they were able to conduct on this 209 acres. I can personally vouch, as I'm sure Richard will, that it is very well used. There's a lot of people that come and use this for a lot of different reasons. And in fact, I think he said one of the biggest problems they had was keeping people off of it until they could finish the construction of the infrastructure that would allow people to safely come on the site. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Richard Myers. And as I said, Richard works in this program there in Broward County and has worked on the site with me for a long time and is understandably very proud of it, as am I. So, Richard, if you want to go ahead and take it away.
Okay. Can you hear me? Okay. Very good. Good afternoon, everybody. As Bill said, thank you, Bill. My name is Richard Myers, and I'm program manager with Broward County Solid Waste and Recycling Services. And I'd like to take most of the credit, but I could tell you that the folks that came before me deserve most of it. I've been with the county for 12 years, working on this site and others, and a lot of this work was done, some of the forward thinking and planning and the initial push to complete this project was done anywhere from the mid-80s into the early 90s and mid-90s. And I could just tell you that the county, and it is a county-owned site located in the town of Davie, that the residents are now realizing the successes at the site. So let me go ahead and give you some background. There may be some overlap into what Bill said, but I want to give you some background and then go through the transformation of the site. As Bill said, we're located in Southeast Florida. The Davie landfill is about 5 miles west of Fort Lauderdale, located in the town of Davie. Davie is one of 31 municipalities located in Broward County. Again, this is a Broward County owned site. Just an overview of the site and the operations. The landfill operations occurred between 1964 and 1987. It says 210 acres is plus or minus. The site was comprised of two landfill areas. There was a municipal solid waste incinerator, as Bill said, operating from 1964 to 1975. There was a trash landfill to the south, about 68 acres, operating from the origination from 1964 through the closure of the site or the ceasing of acceptance of waste in 1987. There was a sanitary landfill or municipal solid waste landfill built 48 acres, was constructed in 1975 and then ran its course all the way through the closure of the facility. This north landfill area, the sanitary landfill, did include a leachate collection system and did have a, I would say, not the most sophisticated liner system, but ultimately it was engineered after the fact, and I'll give you a little bit of detail on how that system was put in place. And, of course, Bill mentioned there was an unlined sludge lagoon located, I'll show you some aerials, and we'll get an idea what that was. due to groundwater contamination issues resulting from the sludge lagoon activities, the site was placed on the National Priorities List in 1983. Giving you some historical perspective, the incinerator commenced operations in 1964, and you can see it basically over here operating. There was a trash landfill accepting incinerator ash, C&D, construction demolition and materials, bulk trash, and unburned solid waste. And this is the origin of the operations at the site. Moving to 1971, now you can see over in this area where the sludge lagoon was created. And again, as Bill said, it disposed of grease trap waste, septic tank waste, and municipal waste water treatment plant sludge. You can also see that the trash landfill in this area is expanding, and the incinerator is still in operation at this time. By 1975, however, the incinerator operation shut down due to changes in the air regulations. And in 75, you can see that there is the construction of what we call the sanitary landfill, the north landfill area. And the trash landfill continued to operate, taking in things like C&D and other bulk items, but all of the municipal solid waste that was being burned at the incinerator was now being placed in the sanitary landfill from that point. Moving on to 1984, both landfills are in full-blown operations. Again, you've got your northern sanitary landfill and your trash landfill to the south. However, the sludge lagoon operations in 1981 were shut down due to potential groundwater contamination concerns. And also, at this time in 1984, the parties, the county, the town of Davie, discussions with regulatory agencies and so forth, the landfill was projected to cease operations by 1987. In 1985, there was a record of decision passed in September. It did address the contamination associated with the sludge lagoon, which was termed the operable unit number one. Broward County developed a closure plan for the sludge lagoon and the landfill, and the record of decision authorized a remedy of source control of the contaminants. The remedy included dewatering and stabilization of the sludge lagoon contents, as Bill mentioned, placement of the stabilized sludge in the sanitary landfill, so the north landfill, and the installation of a low permeability cap on the landfill. The cap is actually a low permeable lime rock cap. And as also Bill mentioned, the cap of the landfill and the closure landfill was conducted in accordance with RCRA under the authority of Florida DEP. Maybe hard to see here, but this is a section view of the north landfill and a section view of the south landfill. And I was trying to describe before that a large portion of the actual landfill, there was basically a cap installed before the final cells were built. It was basically a clay liner, if you will, that is located here. And essentially, it allowed for the collection of rainwater, leachate, and so forth through a series of collection wells and landfill sumps and pump stations and so forth. You had the final cell of the landfill, and this is the north landfill, built in this area over top of the initial cells. And, of course, there were engineering aspects built into this portion because it was later on in the landfill's life that would allow for leachate collection. Don't believe just based on the date that the south landfill was originated that there was any kind of liner system in the south landfill area. In 1987, the Broward County and the town of Davie, you know, realizing that the landfill needed to be closed. They understood that, as Bill mentions again, that the area was very fast growing, and that the demands from the public for new park and recreational facilities were becoming more prominent. A master end use plan was developed. It included analyses and inventory of existing parks, and really just consideration of countywide recreational needs and goals. There were many stakeholders involved in the planning and design process and construction process, obviously including regulatory agencies such as EPA, Florida DEP, public officials, local public officials, local residents, and public interest groups. And the ultimate end-use goals were to increase recreational acreage, provide more open space, reuse land, and, of course, being protective of human health and the environment. Site in 1990, here's my cursor right here. You can see there was remediation completed, which involved, again, excavation, solidification, and disposal of the sludge that was located in the sludge lagoon. A nature pond was essentially created from the sludge lagoon, and you can see in the north and south landfill areas that a lot of the capping is being done and other site features are being incorporated into the overall site, again, with the understanding that they were going to convert, the county was going to convert this to a park, ultimately. Other assessment activities on site, there was another operable unit, number two, and it basically evaluated other sources of contamination and potential remediation. There was a remedial investigation conducted in October 1993, and fortunately the results showed that the sludge lagoon remediation was effective and that there was little to no contamination in groundwater, surface water, sediment, and soils at the site. Was a risk assessment completed in 1993, and it determined that the receptor and pathway was basically the residents through ingestion of groundwater. There were a lot of private potable water wells in the area, and as Bill mentioned earlier, there were some municipal water lines brought in. There was a feasibility study completed in 1994, and ultimately the likely site contaminants that were being looked at were antimony and vinyl chloride in the groundwater. As far as the remedy for the site, natural attenuation of antimony and vinyl chloride was the selected remedy, essentially groundwater monitoring. We were also monitoring, this is the county, I'm sure, the health department and local regulators were monitoring private wells in the surrounding area. And as I mentioned, connection to public water supply for affected residents. also, the remedy included engineering, institutional, and regulatory controls that included landfill capping, management of stormwater, leachate, and landfill gas, groundwater and surface water monitoring, extension of public water supply lines, deed restrictions for the site, and Florida DP regulatory control through essentially a post-closure monitoring permit. There was a record decision issued in 1994 that required the performance of the selected remedy as defined above, and also established performance standards for antimony of 6 micrograms per liter and vinyl chloride of 1 microgram per liter. By 1994, this plan basically shows that the capping of landfill was complete and all the initial park features had been incorporated. Broward County Solid Waste and Parks and Recreation worked together very closely in meeting the future needs for the park use. This plan basically just shows some of the thought process that went into landscaping, at least the landfill areas. There were berms that were built, and the vegetative, the trees and shrubs and so forth that were planted in berms, as is shown by these photos in this slide. You can see very important to protect the integrity of the cap of the landfill. So all of the landscape was carefully planted and carefully monitored. As far as the regulatory status, as far as DEP and EPA were concerned, the official landfill closure was granted by DEP in 1995. It did have a 20-year post-closure monitoring permit period from 1995 to 2015, which is coming up next year. The process to delete the site from the MPL began in 2003-2004. And as a result, that all remedial activities were completed and the remedy continued to be protective of human health and the environment. The engineering, institutional, and regulatory controls were in place and were effective and will continue to be diligently maintained. and of course the performance standards for the antimony and vinylchloride had been met for a period of three years. Based on that, the site was deleted from the National Priorities List in 2006. As far as the initial park transformation, it was made possible through initial funding of our office at the time, which was the Office of Integrated Waste Management, now Solid Waste and Recycling Services, as well as supplemental funding from the 2000 Safe Parks and Land Preservation Bond Referendum. Very important was also trying to design natural habitats on site to hopefully recruit animals found in these habitats, hopefully making the park their home. And as if you visit the park, you can see a lot of those efforts were very successful and are successful today. In 2002, an additional 61 acres were acquired at a cost of $12.8 million, half of which came from the Florida Communities Trust grant and the other half from the 2000 bond program. That basically allowed for the acquisition of 61 acres adjacent to the south of the site. And I'll go into that a little bit further. In 2003, the site opened as Vista View Park. It comprised actually 160 acres of the 210 acres. It didn't at the time and doesn't at this time comprise the north landfill area, which is about 49 acres. The amenities included two picnic shelters, fishing dock, paved trails, horse trails, restrooms, an airstrip for model planes and paraglider pilots, and lookout areas at the top of the landfill, and that area would be the south landfill. As the county acquired the 61 acres to the south, it allowed for an expansion to the south, and the expansion was complete in 2009-2010 timeframe. It included additional amenities, two playgrounds, basketball courts, seven more picnic shelters, fitness stations, boat rental area, equestrian corral, and more equestrian trails, primitive camping areas, and additional parking. And the total construction cost for the expansion was approximately $7.2 million. Part of the expansion features included a fully accessible playground for children of all ability levels. It's named Caitlin's Corral, and it was actually named for Caitlin Munson, who died of spinal muscular atrophy in 2002 at a very young age. This playground was awarded a certification from Boundless Playgrounds for exceeding the minimum requirements of the ADA and standards of the playground industry, and it also incorporated universal design practices and child development theories to meet the Boundless standards. The expanded features at the park included an airstrip for radio control planes, and as I mentioned before, paraglider pilots, a second fishing pier, and an area for primitive group camping and two restrooms. A 1.2-mile loop trail offering several different fitness stations, radio-controlled car track, and 2.1-mile horse trail loops around the park, and which are actually connected to many, many miles of trails throughout the town of Davie. The town of Davie has a long history, equestrian history in the past, and continues to be very involved with that, and the park works, and the features of the park work very well into the town of Davie's history and what the residents want. Just to give you a quick overview of the area, this is what the facility looks like today. This area is the north landfill and is not actually part of the area open to the public yet. There is a fishing pier and a picnic shelter located in this area. This is the south landfill area here, and you've got paved parking up top. You've got equestrian trail that runs around the landfill area, a model airplane field, and you also have a picnic shelter and restrooms here, administrative offices. This area here was the 61-acre expansion area that includes the basketball courts, the fishing pier, the boat dock, a multi-purpose trail with exercise stations. You've got some event fields here, an equestrian corral, and all of this area is basically an equestrian trail. It runs pretty much the entire side. It actually ends about right here, but it continues all the way around and connects up to that south landfill area. You've got additional picnic shelters and the two playgrounds that I mentioned earlier, additional restrooms. And, of course, you can see that the area is surrounded by developments, both to the east and west. They're fairly new developments. And as Bill mentioned, in 2010, Broward County received the EPA Region 4's Excellence in Site Reuse Award in recognition of its outstanding efforts in redeveloping the Davie Landfill into Vista View Park. And just a few shots of some of the activities that are going on today. You see this stuff happening daily. There are a lot of summer camps to take advantage of the facility. This is one of the playground areas. There's an event going on here, probably either a running race or a bicycle race. You see a bicycle race being run here. There are boat rental areas, canoes and paddle boats, and some of the equestrian riders taking advantage of the South Landfill area. And this looks like a 5K running race. And this area here is actually where the radio-controlled airplanes, that's the area where they utilize. You can see some of them operating here. Just part of the top of the south landfill area, just with picnic benches and some trees. And there's one of the paragliders that are using the area. And just to conclude, with proactive thinking and action, you know, it essentially took this facility from a negative stigma, a Superfund site, a landfill site that was around since 1964, and it transformed it into a beautiful regional park, a Broward County Regional Park, that continues to increase with use from the residents. Its initial conversion to a park, which occurred in 2003, afforded the opportunity to expand the park beyond its original landfill site, which was the 210 acres, and allowed for the additional 61 acres of land to be ascertained and constructed, creating an opportunity to incorporate more of an active component into the park use. The facility brings great value to the community, and none of the park features, obviously a very important part of the transformation, they don't compromise the landfill cap in any way. The site continues to be protective of human health and the environment. And I can tell you personally, it's hard to imagine until you actually go out to the park and witness it for yourself and how beautiful it really is. We don't have much in a way of relief in South Florida, and that south landfill area has an elevation of about 65 feet. And just viewing it from the top and from the bottom, it's a beautiful thing to see going again from what it was to what it is today. We're really proud of it, and we just hope it continues to get increased use, and we believe that it will as things continue to develop. Bill, did you want to add anything more to the presentation?
No, Richard, I did a great job going over it. I just echo, you know, I guess one of the things that, you know, we talked about just a couple of days ago is, you know, when they started developing this as a kind of a passive use park, I don't think the county had any idea, you know, of all the varied uses that would occur there. And so, you know, I just applaud the county at being open to different things. And, you know, there's some really unique activities that take place there, and you know, like Richard said, not only do they not have, you know, hills in the area that people can use, but just space in general is at a premium there. So having a place to fly airplanes or to do, you know, remote control cars or remote control boats or whatever is a big deal. And so I think it's certainly something that, you know, people love around there, and you know, certainly come a long way since the days when it was a landfill.
Yep, and I will tell you, there are a whole lot of athletic groups that come out there. The training on those hills, it's extremely popular. Every time I'm there, I see a different group of people basically running those hills. And it's hard to think that you can get a better place to work out seriously. And there are some premier athletes that go out there and train, professional athletes as well. So real happy to see that sort of thing. So anyway, that pretty much concludes it.
That is great, Richard. Thank you very much, and thank you, Bill. I think what I'd like to do is we have some questions, and I'd like to take time to answer those. And while we're going over the questions, we can switch the slide view to the survey screen. So I hope while we're talking, you'll fill out the survey, and you'll even submit some more questions. We use your feedback when we consider future webinar topics, so feel free to let us know what topics you'd like to see, and add your email address at the bottom left if you'd like to be on our notification list for future webinars. So let me take some questions that have come up on Davy Landfill. Let's see. As the post-closure monitoring period ends next year, does this mean that no monitoring at all will occur after that point?
Well, first of all, we've not gone through that process. We're about ready to go through that process with Florida DEP. And as far as no monitoring, we're still responsible. The county is responsible for the site. And we will do what we need to do to keep the site in the best condition. Obviously, it's being used by the public. And eventually, my understanding is that North Landfill area will also be turned over and used as part of the park. My understanding is a lot of the requirements that are part of that post-closure permit are not going to be required in the future, such as groundwater monitoring. That being said, we do have leachate collection, and we do convey the leachate over to a city publicly owned treatment works. We're going to continue to do that. We're going to continue to maintain the slopes and the landfill areas. And obviously, we're responsible. The county is responsible for any potential issues that occur from the facility. But as far as the monitoring that's required, a lot of those requirements do, if in fact DEP agrees, which I believe that they will, based on the status of the site, that a lot of those requirements will not be required in the future.
That's great. I've got a question about the North Landfill. You touched on it briefly. So are there plans? Is there any particular holdup? What's happening?
Well, the North Landfill, recently we were able to decommission the landfill gas collection and control system. That was only a couple of years ago. And we were able to show that the gas generation was essentially negligible. So after decommissioning that system, I think we had about 39 gas wells located in the north of landfill area. All of those now have been decommissioned. They're no longer there. The enclosed flare that was there since 1994 time period is now no longer there. It's been demolished. So that was one of the main components of moving toward, eventual turnover. There will be some more analysis to make sure that we look very closely at our drainage system and our leachate collection system. It's very intricate, and make sure that those areas are well-defined and protected for safety reasons, and to make sure that any infrastructure that exists is also not damaged. So there's quite a number of things that need to be looked at. We hope to be able to turn it over soon. It would add another, just another piece to the puzzle. And that hill is actually about 85 foot, plus 85 in elevation. So we're hoping to do that, but we have to go through a period of due diligence and make sure that all the boxes are checked before that happens.
Great. I've got another question for you. What was the public response to early ideas for the park? Did EPA or the county need to take any special steps to alleviate concerns for public health?
Well, I can tell you that there were plenty of telephone calls from residents in the area. I didn't receive too many calls from people that didn't live in the area. But it was more about, I think, with any concerns that they might have had moving close to a former landfill site or a closed landfill and a Superfund site, for that matter. But I think that just based on the data that we have, you know, quite a bit of groundwater data to demonstrate that there really are no environmental issues associated with the site. And we were always very open to explaining to whoever, you know, wanted the information what we've done to be able to make the site safe. I wasn't with the county just before the period where a lot of the discussion was going on the fact that they were going to be opening up in 2003, as I just came on with the county in 2002. But I would expect that a lot of those issues were addressed through some sort of public forums and such. That's as much as I know about it.
Okay, and I've got another question. It sounds like reuse at the site has grown beyond the original park design concept. So you touched on this a little bit, but what is the process when a new reuse idea is proposed for a portion of the park?
That's a very good question. The Parks and Recreation Group are interested because they're hearing from their residents and the residents in the community what they would like to see. There could be all sorts of potential uses. Our biggest concern, obviously, understanding that we have to be protective of the environment and human health, that that we don't compromise the cap of the landfill. So whatever use, potential use there is, it would have to be, if in fact there was going to be some intrusive construction, we would have to make sure that it is well in line with acceptable engineering practice for closed landfill. So we would look at it very, very carefully. Right now, all the uses are very superficial, and we obviously maintain the cap and make sure that we're erosion is addressed, and any kind of settlement and things like that, which really hasn't been any real differential settlement at either one of the landfill sites. But we would certainly be looking at those potential uses, working with the parks group and obviously with the regulatory community as well, to make sure, at least at this time, if there were anything proposed, that there would be no concerns.
This is Melissa. This is Bill. I'd like to add to that, and it's something that Richard is talking about here, and I just want to point out from a regulator's point of view, looking in, and a redevelopment coordinator, is in Broward County, it appears the Parks and Recreation people work very closely with the solid waste people, and I know in some I've had experiences where sometimes they almost seem like their missions conflict with each other. The Parks and Recreation want to provide parks for people, and the solid waste people want to protect the integrity of a landfill cap. And so, I've seen landfill people say, we really, we don't want to have uses come here because we're concerned about damaging the landfill cap, and, parks people, having difficulty working with that. And so I think this is, in addition to being a great example of the types of uses that can occur on a landfill, I think it's also an example of how local government can work within itself with different departments with different missions to serve their constituents and the residents of their county in a very good way. And so I applaud them on not only a great park but being open to the fact, because it's extra work. I mean, it's extra work for the solid waste people, rather than just mowing a closed landfill, to have to consider these things and make sure that they're not that they're being done in a protective way, and make sure that there are no issues going to be associated with the use of it. And so I think that's a for the people on the phone, that may be having issues with that, this would be a really good example to point to if you do run into those types of problems, to say, no, it can be done, and here's an example of where it was done.
Thanks, Bill. I've got a couple more questions. Somebody suggested maybe baseball is coming, but what they're wondering is the landfill located in the Karst limestone geologic area, i.e. caves, I guess, are they natural conduits for transport? How extensive was exploration testing and analysis?
Go ahead.
And Richard, you want to take that one, or Richard and I both got involved with this site kind of after a lot of this work was done, because I started in the late 90s, so the investigation work had pretty much been done. But this was done through a Superfund remedial investigation. It was also done through RCRA landfill closure, and so there were differences in the groundwater monitoring network and what was considered to be adequate sampling for the groundwater. And so, you know, we approached it in Superfund as a CERCLA remedy. So we, of course, you know, sampled people's wells that were nearby in the area, and that's what prompted some of the connection of homes to public water. And then, of course, there were monitoring wells, just like with any Superfund site. But this is the Biscayne Aquifer area. And yeah, it's a sole source aquifer. It's a very important resource in South Florida, and it's one that's very, very closely looked at and very, very strictly protected.
Right, and also just to add to it is this area is not really, at least the area where the town of Davie, it's not really, you don't see sinkhole formation very often. Very seldom do you see anything like that. So as far as stability is concerned, I know that other areas of the state are different. But we don't see that sort of thing down in this area.
Okay, I've got one more question for you, and then I'll go back to Iron Horse Park. But let's see, what was the elevation of the site after placement of the cap, and how much fill was placed on top of the cap?
Okay. As I said, we have had even settlement over time, but the elevation last survey that we've done of the south mound was a 65, plus or minus 65 feet, and the north landfill was 85 feet. I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
How much fill was placed on top of the cap?
My understanding was there was at least 2 feet of fill, but from what I've seen, it's more than that. In many parts of the landfill. But my understanding was after the initial cover was put down that there was at least 2 feet of low permeable lime rock material put in place. Again, I'd have to look at the detail of that, but that's my understanding.
Okay, thanks. I want to switch back to Iron Horse Park and Shepherd Landfill, and I guess this is a question for Urban Green Technologies. Would you consider additional projects like Shepherd, and if so, what would you do differently? So I guess this is for Sandy, Cameron, and Nicola.
Right. Actually, this was a very good learning experience. Because of the breadth and depth of the whole project, I think we learned a lot from it. We learned that a team approach is very important in working with all the powers to be, and I think moving forward, we'd certainly be interested in doing a similar type project. We've got one under our belt, and I think it would be interesting to pursue others.
That's always good news. I'd like to ask Allison, can you explain a little bit more about payment in lieu of taxes? It was the pilot thing that you guys mentioned before.
Sure. So we, you know, UGT might be able to speak to this better than I can, but we, the project has an arrangement with the town of Billerica where we basically pre-negotiated 25 years of taxes in lieu of property taxes. So, you know, that from an investor perspective, that was really great because we have a lot of visibility into, you know, our exact liabilities and cash flows over the next 25 years.
Great, thanks. I hope you all noticed we put up the SRI coordinators by region on your screen. So if you have any questions about reuse, about redevelopment, get in touch with those people. You can get in touch with me. Certainly, I think all the presenters today would be happy to talk to you. I think at this point we're pretty much done, and I'm going to turn it over to Michelle.
Okay, great. Thanks, Melissa. I'm just going to pull up a few concluding slides. And mention to you again, as Jean Ballant mentioned at the beginning of our session, that we do have a number of archived webinars on Superfund redevelopment. And on this slide here, you will see that a link that will take you to those webinars. And as you can see, we have 22 of them. We will be continuing to develop these webinars. So please stay tuned and watch our website and get on our mailing list, and we hope to see you again in our presentation. And with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to Jean to do the final wrap-up of our webinar.
All right. Thank you so very much, Michelle. I'm just going to walk everyone through a few final reminders before we close things out today. First of all, for those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials that we used for today's session, you'll find those already posted on the Resources or Links page. That's active off of the seminar homepage, but you can also access it under the Related URLs window that you'll see to the middle right of your screen. You can simply scroll through that window. Again, you'll find Seminar Resources or Links. You can click on that and then press the Browse To button, and that'll open up the website locally on your own computer. The other thing we'll ask, if you can take just a moment and fill out the short feedback form online to let us know what you thought of today's session. We did note a few brief momentary technical glitches at the kickoff of today's webinar. We do apologize for that, but it looks like we were able to quickly resolve that within the first moment of the session. But you're certainly welcome to let us know if you did encounter other difficulties or you were unable to fix that before joining us today. You can click on the link to the feedback form. You'll also find that, again, under Related URLs as Seminar Feedback Form. Each person who attended today is welcome to fill out their own feedback form. So if you shared the line with multiple people, feel free to fill it out individually. The other thing I'll note is that for those of you looking for copies of training certificates or CEUs or PDHs for today's session, we don't necessarily issue training certificates usually for our CLUIN sessions. However, many participants are able to earn credit for participating from their respective organizations. I encourage you to download or print out a copy of the presentation homepage, which has information about today's session, and then fill out the short feedback form. When you fill that feedback form out, there's a box you can check right here that's circled in red. As long as your name and email address are entered correctly and that box is checked, we will send you a confirmation email which does verify the date and time you submitted feedback. So as long as that's after the live date, that's usually enough to give you credit from your accrediting institution. Again, if you are one of the people watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you too can still follow the links to the seminar resources as well as that short seminar feedback form, and feel free to fill that out and get a confirmation email. I want to thank the nearly 90 individuals who were able to join us all over the country for today's live webinar. For those of you who weren't able to stay on for the full broadcast, we did record today's session, and we will automatically send an email in approximately 1 week with a link to replay the recorded version. And you're certainly welcome to share that with others that you think will find this useful session to replay. I think this wraps up our formal reminders for today's session, so I want to also, again, thank the instructors and organizers who helped put today's session together, and that we'll either see you all or hear from you on a future CLUIN webinar. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.